I specifically asked Mike not to do a scripture reading, so he didn't forget, and I didn't forget. I thought about asking him to stand up and give a random scripture reading because I didn't want to give away the punchline to my lesson before I ever start. Because I want to take you on a journey. I want to take you somewhere, and I want you to be confused by it at first, where we're going. So I am the substitute speaker. Mitch called me night before last and said he may need some help for today, and then he called up and said that yes, he did need help yesterday. Now you'll have Justin Witt this evening, so it's the day of Justin's speakers. I like to sync up those names like that. I'm just kidding, I didn't. So he'll be on for this evening. I want to tell you a couple of stories. I'm going to start with the story of a kid named Peter. Peter's just a regular kid growing up in the suburbs. He walks to school every day because he lives so close. And one particular Wednesday, as he's walking home, he sees a rock that he likes. And he goes to pick it up. He notices it's an interesting combination of reds and greens. And so he puts it in his pocket to save for later and continues on his way. Later that day, he goes out into the forest behind his house and plays in the woods until his mother calls him for dinner. Dinner was his favorite, macaroni and cheese. That night, as he goes to sleep, he thinks of the walk tomorrow and whether he will find another rock. He goes to sleep with happy thoughts of rocks and trees and macaroni and cheese. And the next day, he goes to school the same way, but although he looks, he doesn't find any other rocks like the one he had already found. Now let's talk about Laura. Laura's from the heart of Philadelphia. She has a friend named Katie, and every day they meet up for a game of basketball in the playground between their two houses. One day, Katie takes a shot and misses completely. The ball goes over the fence and into the yard of an empty house. The girls are unhappy with this, but they decide to figure out some way to get their ball back. Katie boosts Laura over the fence, but before she jumps down on the other side, she hears a growl, and she looks up. The house wasn't deserted after all. In her fear, Laura loses her balance and falls off the fence and onto the grass on the other side. There's something wrong with these stories. They have no plot. I've implied a plot by the way I've told them, right? I've kind of taken you somewhere, and then I've purposely dropped you off a cliff. I just whip these things up overnight. They don't have any meaning. They never go anywhere. I have no idea what happens to Laura, and I have no idea if Peter ever finds another rock. I spent about 15 minutes on these things, and I thought about making them even more meaningless, although I thought that might kind of give the game away. I was struck to do this lesson. One day I was sitting and I was listening to something, and I wish I could remember what it was, but it occurred to me that it's got to be the greatest apologetic for there being a God that we expect there to be a plot to this story. As humans, we create stories out of everything. Have you ever noticed that? It's everything. This world is saturated with stories. Even where there's not obvious stories, we generate them. So if you look at the news, right, there's this concept of what's called the narrative. And people will report, you know, you'll watch this channel and you'll say, well, this is a liberal channel. Okay, and on this news station, they will report certain pieces of the story, and they'll leave out other pieces. And so in that way, they'll construct meaning into the story. Okay, they'll inject it in there. Maybe some right to abortion, or maybe some sort of pro-liberal idea. And then you'll flip the channel, and you'll go to a channel that's maybe more conservative. And on that channel, they'll do kind of the same thing, because they also have a narrative. There's a story that they're trying to tell, right? They're trying to get something across to you. They're saying that these events have meaning, okay? That the story that you're living, that this whole world is living, has a meaning. Whenever there's some school shooting or some recent thing like happened in San Bernardino, everybody looks for meaning. All the narrative engines start up. You see it, you know, on all the news stations. It begins to clog Facebook. People say the meaning here is that we need to have gun control. That's the plot line to this story. That's the overall meaning. That every fact must be built into that. Another person says, no, no, no. The meaning of this story is that, you know, that Islam is this great worldwide religion that will slowly destroy everything in its path. And so that becomes the story, right? The plot line. The dirty secret about all of this is that if there is no God, if atheism is true, if all there is in this universe is just this universe, and everything just came about from, say, matter and motion and time and chance, you're just an accident, like a lot of people say, then none of those things, those stories are like the two I told. They have no plots. They have no meaning. There's no meaning to what happened in San Bernardino. There's no subversive plot. There's nothing going on there. There's no purpose to those things. But you can't live that way. Humans have to have a plot. I want to tell a couple of stories from when I was in my high school English class. These are not like the stories before. These stories have a meaning. So I remember we had a small class, and I loved that class. We sat around, and it was like the Dead Poets Society or something. You know, we all sat around. We read these things, and then Mr. Shane was my teacher, and I still see him around town sometime. He's retired now. But there was maybe about, I don't remember, maybe 9 or 10 of us in class. It was a small class. He wasn't a popular teacher, and you got to pick him or the other guy. And the other guy was very popular. He had a big class. But Mr. Shane, we all loved Mr. Shane. We'd sit around in this little half circle around him, and then we'd talk about, you know, the meaning of some poem. And I'll never forget this one in particular. And maybe you've heard this before. It's by a poet named William Carlos Williams. And it goes like this. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. That's the whole poem. Mr. Shane would get this kind of smirk on his face, and he would look at us and say, well, what does this mean? And none of us had any idea. I mean, I don't know. It's so short. There's not much to it. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. How? How could anything depend on this red wheelbarrow? How could anything depend on the chickens? It paints this beautiful picture, but at the very first line of it says, there's a meaning here, right? It's like a big signpost. The poem would have been totally different if it just said, a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. You would say, oh yeah, it's just drawing a picture. It's making an image. But that's not what happens. It says, so much depends on this picture, meaning that I'm telling you this really means something. And so Mr. Shane looks around us with this smirk on his face, and he says to us finally after a while, he says, does it change anything if I tell you that William Carlos Williams was a doctor in his day job and that he was sitting beside the bed of a dying patient and he looks out the window and he sees this picture, right? Well, yeah, that changes everything. Now what's happening is we get this picture of the surgeon, right? And he's trying to save this young girl and he looks outside and he's imbuing the world around him with meaning. Why? Because of the death of this person in front of him. Now, what's interesting about that story is that I went online to go make sure I had my facts straight, right? And here's what's funny, is I didn't find anything that really talked about that latter half of it. As a matter of fact, people today still argue about what this poem means and whether or not William Carlos Williams just wrote it because, you know, he wanted to try to create meaning where there was none and then make everybody guess about it. That would have been kind of a common thing to do during the time that he was writing it. I don't know if you've ever read much existentialist literature. This is the other piece of my English studies that I want to talk about. But we had to read The Stranger by Albert Camus. And I hated this book. I hated this book so much, I cannot even tell you how much I hated this book. I hated this book from the first line of the book. And I want to read to you just from the very first line. And it goes like this. Mother died today, or maybe yesterday. I can't be sure. The telegram from the home says, your mother passed away, funeral tomorrow, deep sympathy, which leaves the matter doubtful it could have been yesterday. From the very first line, I understood that Camus, I didn't dislike the book because I misunderstood it. I disliked the book because I understood it was telling me exactly what it was saying, which is that his mother's death had no meaning to him. It was utterly absurd. This goes all the way through the whole book. He eventually is sentenced to die, and at the end, this is what we find. At the very end of the book, almost for the first time in many months, I thought of my mother, and now it seemed to me I understood why at her life's end she had taken on a fiancé, why she'd played at making a fresh start, there too in that home where she lives, where lives were flickering out. The dusk came as a mournful solace with death so near. Mother must have felt like someone on the brink of freedom, ready to start life all over again. No one in the world had any right to weep for her, and I too felt ready to start life all over again. It was as if that great rush of anger had washed me clean, emptied me of hope, and gazing up at the dark sky spangled with its signs and stars for the first time, the first, and I want you to listen to the next phrase. Because what this story is exactly like the ones I told at the beginning. Okay? Because his next phrase right here, he's injected huge amounts of meaning into these words, right? I mean, the whole thing just reeks of meaning. And yet, he says, the first, I laid my heart open to the benign indifference of the universe. The existentialists had, as a very common theme throughout them, that your life is utterly meaningless. It's absurd, right? Now, that always ended up with a focus upon death. And they would attempt to create death as this absurd idea. You find this in the other thing I hated studying in English, which was Theater of the Absurd. So there's a whole bunch of different Theater of the Absurd plays. You might have heard of one called Waiting for Godot, which is just a couple of guys that are sitting there chatting and they wait for a third guy named Godot to show up, and he never shows up the entire play. Okay? Now here's a description of a famous, that's written by a playwright named Samuel Beckett. Okay, so he writes this other one called Endgame. This is a description of Endgame. There are four characters in Endgame, and they're described as so. One of them is Ham. He's unable to stand and blind. One of them is Clove, servant of Ham. He's unable to sit. Nag is Ham's father. He has no legs and lives in a dustbin. And Nell, Ham's mother, has no legs and lives in a dustbin next to Nag. The main character, Ham, behaves badly in a manner seemingly guaranteed to ensure that no audience member would like him or care about what happened to him. He succeeds. At the end, he is alone in an apparently depopulated world, his parents Nell and Nag dead on stage in their garbage bins, and abandoned by his long-suffering servant Clove, he is doomed to starve to death. He has shown no emotion when Nell died, and Nag in mourning cried before dying, presumably of a broken heart. I want you to notice a common theme here. Death, which is usually the very thing that kind of is this thing we all face, this thing that must give us meaning somehow, to the existentialists was this idea that you had to drain death of meaning. Notice how Camus does this in The Stranger, right? Where he says, my mother died today. When I read that line, I remember thinking, my mother died today would be the most profound impact upon me. And yet he purposely says, this has no meaning. Why? Because he's trying to live according to his conviction that there's no plot. Do you see? He's trying to live according to the fact that there's no story. He doesn't believe in God. He believes that the universe is benignly indifferent to him. It's a machine. You're a machine. And as a machine, it has no meaning. The interesting thing about this to me is that God addresses this in the Bible. Okay? So it's one of those proofs, right, that the Bible is true. Because where are we going to go now? Ecclesiastes 1:1-2. The words of the teacher of David, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Wow. Fantastic start to a book, right? But it's stuck in the Bible. And the whole Bible is about the fact that there is profound meaning. Where does he go from this? I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. That's the word translated meaningless in some translations. Vanity. It's nothing, right? It's just purposeless. I searched my heart, how to cheer my body with wine. My heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart from pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. In that one passage that I read, it's kind of an extended piece there, but I read the whole thing because in that one passage, he summed up everything that we humans try to do to find meaning. Have you noticed that? The seeking for wealth, right? Look at it. He talks about the fact that he has all these things, that he became more wealthy than anyone else. The finding meaning in our jobs, right? He says, look, I built these great things. He was a king, he says, I built these great projects, and they went so well. Well, that would be great. Isn't that what we all kind of yearn for in our jobs? We go to work, and we hope that we can be a part of building something great. I mean, that's one of the whole reasons why it's so much fun sometimes to work on base, right? Because you're part of building some great thing, okay? And you find some meaning there. And there's nothing really wrong with that in the context of Christianity if we keep our priorities straight. But the teacher here is trying to explore and say, can I generate a plot? Does my story have a plot, okay? Is there a meaning to this life if I toil as hard as I can and do fantastic in my work? He says no. What if I try to get as wealthy as I can? He says no. What if I try drinking as much as possible? He tries getting drunk and feeding himself with pleasure. And isn't that what a lot of people do? No, the answer's not there either. He even tries, this is hidden, of course, a little bit, he tries sex. He says, I have these concubines, right? He tries the stuff, the very things that we humans all try to pour into our lives to give our lives meaning. And he says, they're all rendered meaningless. Why? He even tries wisdom. This is an interesting one. Just a verse later, so I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there's more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is in more gain in light than in darkness. Oh, that sounds good. Maybe here's the plot he's looking for. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Good stuff. Maybe it's wisdom. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this is also vanity. So he seeks wisdom for wisdom's sake, just like he had sought pleasure for pleasure's sake. And he had sought toil for toil's sake, for the sake of making great things. He had set each one of those up as a sort of god, if you will. He had tried to find a meaning in each one, and he found meaninglessness in all of them. And right at the end, we see why. One of the great themes throughout the book of Ecclesiastes is, if you die, and everybody dies, then nothing you're doing here has any meaning at all. Nothing. Someday, all the work that you're doing out there on base, no one will care about. I guess if they name a building after you, although I went to a building lately in Point Mugu and I wondered who the guy was, and I took a little bit of time just to try to look up what I could, and there was no information about him at all except a small plaque on the front. So that's all he's got left. But he must have been quite a fellow. He's got a whole building named after him, right? But yet, there's no meaning. I'm not saying that you shouldn't work hard. Don't misunderstand me. But the book of Ecclesiastes is about the fact that if you're doing these things for these things' purpose, if you're trying to find the plot line in your story, okay, and you're saying the plot line here in my story is that I get rich, and that's the answer, and everybody lives happily ever after. No, that's not the answer. You might say to yourself, well, the plot line is that I become great at my job, and I work really hard, and I do amazing things, and everybody lives happily ever after. No, that's also not the plot line. Why? Because people don't live ever after. People die. That's what they do. Okay? So, all of your life, without the concept of something going beyond it, is rendered meaningless by death. The existentialist poets understood this, right? The writers, Camus, understood that. That's why he was so fixated on this concept of death. It rendered, the fact that death happens, renders everything within his life as meaningless nonsense at that point. Now, the existentialist answer was, if you read Sartre, for example, it's, oh, embrace it. Embrace the meaninglessness and just do whatever you want and be a libertine and go around and just, you know, usually it's sexual freedom, right? And then just sin and sin and sin and sin and sin, because that's usually the answer. And of course, that's the reason why a lot of people search for answers like that, is because that's what they want out of it. But yet, those stories are so depressing, because you and I both know that they have no plot. They have no meaning. And so Camus' Stranger ends up this terrible tragedy and this terribly sad thing. And I understood that when I read it as a kid. It's not a happy thing. It's not, yay, life has no meaning. I can do whatever I want. It's how sad. He doesn't even care that his mother died. What a terrible thing. But Camus' answer would have been, it has no meaning that his mother died. None of this has any meaning. I was struck the other day as I was reading a history on World War I. It talks about all these deaths. Yet everybody from that war is dead now, right? If those things stand in isolation, and if there is no God, then those stories are like the two I told at the beginning. Great. Millions of people fought a war and a bunch of million people died, and it has no meaning. I'm sorry, it has none. And in 100 years, that meaning will fade more, and in 1,000 years, it'll fade more. And pretty soon, you'll look back on it like we read about in the Bible sometimes, where, oh, look at that, 400,000 guys went and they died in Armageddon. And you go, wow, that's some numbers, and that's really interesting. But what meaning does that have? And it's only rendered meaningful by the fact that something is beyond this story. If you ask your pet to write a story for you, what kind of story will you get? You will get nonsense, right? You know, sometimes, if any of you have cats, you know what this is like. The cat wants to be wherever you are, but in the most inappropriate way possible. And so, if you're typing and you're very fixated on something, the cat jumps up and walks across the keyboard. Does the cat generate meaning with the things that it walks across the keyboard with? If it lays on the keyboard, right, what happens to a computer keyboard if you press down on things? Well, it starts repeating. Well, the cat that way, if it goes to sleep, can probably write a few thousand pages of script, you know, depending on how fast your Microsoft Word copy is that you got open. But it will all be garbage. To have a plot in a story requires an author. An author with a mind. The fact that you believe everything about you has a plot. The fact that even the atheists generate plot lines, right? Oh no, all of you humans are killing yourselves. We all have to go to a conference, right? Why? Because climate change. And climate change will change the world as we know it. So what? That's what Camus would have said. So what? Who cares? More deaths early on means less people that have to live with the meaninglessness of this existence. Most of the existentialists would have said, good deal. Let's warm the earth faster. But that's not what you're told, right? You're told, no, vote for these people, right? Because these people are doing something about this global warming problem. But the problem is that most of the people who believe in that don't believe in God either. And so it just doesn't make any sense. It's like a story typed out by a cat that happens to mention warm because for some reason they got those words together. Stories are told by authors, and authors have minds, and minds generate meaning. This story, your story, has a plot because God is an author. We know this because the one key thing that we have from him, I need to bring a Bible with me. You know, sometimes you hold up the Bible and you need, the iPad doesn't work the same way. You can't hold it up and do this with it, right? So the Bible is a book. The book was written by authors, but yet there's this plot line that runs through it all the way from beginning until end. If you stop with just the Old Testament, it's a little bit like the stories I told at the beginning, right? It kind of drops you off a cliff. God is going to save his people. God's going to do great things. Whew, silence. Whew. Did he do that? Did he save them? Did he do great things? I don't know. The story doesn't end. But when you add the New Testament to it, now all of a sudden it becomes a story of worldwide redemption. Not only does he save his people, Israel, but he saves all of us as well. He saves everyone. He sends his son. His son dies on the cross. There's a plot line there as well, right? And then we read that part, and then he's raised from the dead. There's another piece of the plot, another part of the story. The story doesn't end there, and it continues with you. Sometimes we have a tendency, I think, to think that the only plot line there is in the Bible. The only story there is, God has this plan. We see it from the very beginning. In the Garden of Eden, right after the sin of Adam and Eve, he says to Eve what? Your offspring will be at enmity with the serpent and his offspring. And you will, he will bruise your heel, but you will crush his head, right? Your offspring will. So already there's a plan, a plot line, a story being born. And that story carries through. And God, as we see, takes people like Rahab, right? This prostitute who lives in the wall in Jericho, and he makes her, spins her into the story. She helps to save the Israelites. He takes Ruth, a Moabitess, and all of a sudden she's spun into the story. She ends up in the genealogy of Christ. He takes Christ, this person, this no-account carpenter from this little tiny nothing country that Rome wished would have just gone away, but they needed a land bridge to Egypt. And so, you know, they're like a flea. And yet suddenly out of there comes this great, great event. And God laughs at the whole thing. And he says, I'm the author here. I'm making the story. But sometimes we have the tendency to believe that at the end of Revelation, when it all is said and done, that God had a plot line there. He had a story there, but we're not really necessarily a part of that, right? Random stuff just seems to happen in our lives. Is there meaning there? If you're here this morning, you might not realize that there is a story to your life, that there is a plot line. You might believe that, okay, yeah, there was plots someplace else, or maybe somebody made that Bible up. The funny thing is, you can't actually live that way. Nobody can. You live like there's a plot in your life. You live like there's a story. You live like you're in a book, and it's a book that has some meaning. And I would suggest to you today that it does, and that there is a plot line in your life, and that there's an author, and that it has to do with an eternal God. I still believe that when I sat there a few months ago and it occurred to me to do this lesson, that very profound thing that occurred to me when I realized that we humans are story writers ourselves, that we long for our lives to be a story, to have meaning. All too often when you see people and they've committed suicide, it was because they felt all of a sudden that their story had no meaning, that there was no plot, and so they just ended it. But you don't believe that. You believe that there is a plot and that there is meaning. If you're here this morning and you need to come to Christ, he can be a part, a very big part. He can reauthor your life. Have you ever considered that? As Christians, we're asking Christ, we're asking God to change our story into one with a good ending. We're asking God and Christ to say that beyond the death that would render Camus' Stranger meaningless, that there is a meaning out there somewhere. And if you want to have a good ending to your story, if you want to have a plot that ends on happily ever after, then you need an ever after. In order to get that, you have to come to Christ. Because your sins are hampering you from that. If you need to come to Christ today, if you need to be baptized, if you need to repent, or if you just need to give your life back to him, your great author, would you come now as we stand to sing the song that's been selected?